really didn't know what I was looking at, but I knew pretty quickly I wanted to be part of that. So Virgil and I then formed that company. And this is about 3-4 years ago. So.
Yeah, so the idea started sometime around 2005 while I was with MITRE. I was trying to solve some geo-registration problems for UAV video. So, you know, you're given a camera, lat long, altitude, roll pitch yaw, where do the four corners of the image meet on the ground? Using MATLAB, which is a tool some of you may or may not be familiar with. The issue with that is, okay, so you'd run through all the math, then you'd get a set of coordinates, but it'd be really hard to visualize, you know, lots of places for that divide by two error and that flipped negative for things to go wrong. And about that time, Google Earth, the first sort of public version of Google Earth came out, and the first KML spec came out. So I wrote MATLAB code to create KML so I could plot these points in Google Earth, because then it was a lot, because now I could see the satellite image of the same area as the UAV, and I could immediately see was my math right or wrong, usually wrong, but at least you could work towards the solution. Really, ever since college, I've been a little bit of an entrepreneur myself. I had a computer hardware business in college. I kept that a little bit in the Air Force until I got too busy. I always sort of wanted to work on my own. So, you know, at the time, search was really the big thing in, you know, internet companies. And, you know, so I was, you know, sitting at MITRE, somewhat satisfied with my job, but thinking about, you know, if I was going to start a company, what would I do? Well, you don't want to get into internet search because at that time it was Google and Yahoo were clearly entrenched and going at, you know, who was going to win that. You know, that wasn't one or two people weren't going to come in with no money and beat Google at that game. Google Earth really, you know, came out, and also the early Maps API really opened up basically this whole new thing. You know, the geo web had not been, you know, really a concept yet. So it was sort of a, you know, where search was 15, 20 years ago, here now is this thing called the GeoWeb. I said, well, the Google Earth thing's pretty cool. I seem to have some knack at, you know, how to build content for it. You know, business 101 is find something you really like to do and you know about something about. So I said, okay, well, what application space things do I know about? Well, I grew up in a flying family, I knew a lot about aviation. Having at that time been in Florida for 5 years, I knew a fair bit about boating. So I says, well, okay, flying or boating? Fire. I'm like, well, aviation community is very tech savvy, a lot of money, but there's only about 100,000 active pilots in the United States, and the aviation industry is littered with dead small tech companies who basically, you know, innovated, sold to, you know, whatever percentage of the market they could capture, and then really couldn't continue because, again, there's just not enough people to sell to. Boating was much easier because that's millions of people just in the recreational market in the U.S. There's, of course, a global market, particularly on the industrial side. The other, of course, we're thinking about Google Earth and internet and the cockpit even today is not very easily solved. Internet on boats then was, it was really still a little pre-air card, but at least the air card was on the horizon. And a boat, the fastest boat, goes very small distance compared to the slowest airplane. So the other is boating tends to be, at least in the, you know, the distance you're going to go a day in a boat is still pretty small. So again, it was reasonable to expect people could maybe cache charts or imagery that they might need. So at that point, I basically did my market research and said, well, you know, this Google Earth thing's so cool. Surely somebody's making converting NOAA charts from, you know, particularly the ENC format to KML. Well, looking around, there really wasn't anybody systematically doing that. So I took that on as my nights and weekend project. It took about 6 months to write the code. The difficulty with ENC is there are about 185 defined layers. I don't know the exact attribute count, but it's in the 50 to 80 attributes, which are applied without any uniformity to each of those individual layers. So there's a lot of logic that goes into processing a layer, because not only do you have to extract the geo data, you can't just label the layer. A lot of these, of course, to make a chart, it has to be, there's a display aspect. What color is it? If it's a line, what's the line width? What's your priority display settings for when things turn on and off as you zoom for clutter control? And the fact that I had to create an icon set for all the point icons. And again, this is, Google Earth is about two orders of magnitude faster at vector processing today in version 6 as it was then in version 1. So we were also pushing the limit pretty hard on how much you could push into Google Earth without locking it up. And again, that got back into zoom control, and when you scheduled layers to turn on, not only from the user aspect, but from the program aspect. It was, about the time, I think I had about 120 layers done when I met Brad at the mashup camp. We started forming I went into the mashup camp saying, well, this is sort of pretty cool, I thought, but what do I know? I showed it off a little bit. The other people at the mashup kind of thought enough of it, they sort of had this thing where you'd go around and see everybody's demos, 2 minutes at each person, and then they'd all vote on the coolest stuff. I ended up second, even though, most of the stuff was sharing favorite, social movies or stuff a lot more germane to your average techie than marine charts. That dialogue, it took about 3 months of Brad and I going back and forth and getting closer and closer to having a product to form the company. At the time, we have a website called Destin Charts. That was my boating blog for Florida, and sort of my vehicle where I posted some betas. Again, I originally thought, this is a cool hobby project. I'll do this and post it all for free. Once we got some of the betas out, Ben Ellison, who's up in Maine, he's a big electronics writer for the boating industry. A lot of people later came right back and said, hey, you've got a product. We want to pay, people are going to pay money for this. Here's some more things you ought to do with it. And that's...
Can I interject just real quick? So how many of you guys are voters of any magnitude? Yeah, all right, not bad. So have you ever bought...
Canoes count?
What's that?
Do canoes count?
Yeah, well, actually, have any of you ever purchased charts before? Have you ever gone through that process buying a Garmin or buying a Raymarine device and having to get the chips? So one thing that caught my eye, doing a fairly quick read on the business side, was one chip was costing $150. And that was for a region maybe the size of southern Florida, for example, or maybe a little bigger than that. So here this guy was reproducing the entire United States chart set, the same data for free. So that's called disruption in the kind of the tech business parlance. And so that was a big, big eye-opener for us and the opportunity to use that.
Yeah, this is, even for us now, we're 4 years into this, but it's like an eternity ago. This was pre-iPhone. The notion that we all had maps on iPhones and iPads, Google Earth really was revolutionary in its time because it was really the first non-enterprise level mapping product that anybody could put data into. That was really the extreme disruption. At that time, if you wanted electronic charts, that meant at a minimum a $400 handheld GPS with a minimum $100 chart chip on top just to get a small region. So that led to what we called Earth and Sea Plus, which was our vector ENC data product for Google Earth. Commercial release was June 2007, about 1.2 gigabytes of data for the whole U.S. At the time, this is also, NOAA at the time had only really done about 600 of the 1,000 charts, raster charts, over to ENC format. So we launched with 600, and then we were adding charts every month as NOAA published more and more of the ENCs. Through the same process, again, I was still sort of being a little bit of a Google Earth junkie, getting into, what else can we put with it? So going after hacking NOAA Marine Forecast, hacking their station file to get all the lat longs, and then that's still output primarily in a really weird text format with really strange text delineation. So again, writing a parser to try and extract the forecast from the junk and label everything. FAA by then actually was putting METAR, which is your airport weather, hourly airport weather, was available via XML. So again, something to read that in, put it in a database so that could generate hourly KML that actually changed the icons based on the actual weather. So again, you didn't have to click on things to know what the weather was. High predictions, And again, at that, you know, that was the heyday of the early KML, of everybody trying to build their first KML. So a lot of just web indexing of, you know, favorite boating places in the Chesapeake from some boat club. And we'll pop out to Google Earth here for a sec and just show a little of this. So let me zoom in here. So this is our vector charts. Your numbers there, you're seeing the depth soundings as we zoom in. Of course, your nautical buoys. Again, all the layer rules that go into how these are styled, what icons are used. This is a case, again, one of the problems with the way ENCs are built is you have approach charts and harbor charts that overlap each other. And for the most part, the data in both is the same, except the harbor soundings will have denser depth soundings. And so some of how NOAA still handles electronic chart data is archaic, because what it really should be is gridded and some have some density value built into the points, but it really should just be one thing. Because otherwise you create these strange rules. And what's worse is the geo-coordinates of the same buoy in the harbor chart and the approach chart are often off. Because they digitized these from raster charts at different scales, and they didn't go back and apply a normalization that says, you know, if it's buoy number two, it should be the same coordinate in any chart we put it in, and it should be at the highest resolution that we extracted it. And so some of that's still in process. And there's each element in a chart has a unique ID, but only within the chart, not globally. So again, it's very hard to do duplication elimination, because if you just use coordinates, you'll miss them because they're not the same. So again, we also, you know, pulling out the metadata, formatting the metadata on a layer level. One of the challenges of Google Earth is it's Google's. So while it's a really cool, neat platform, we don't own it. So, and we'll talk about this here in a slide or two. One of the challenges in doing something like this is we had to build it so that the user could understand how to use it using Google's interface. And so sometimes the engineering solutions dictated doing things sort of suboptimally, in our view, but sort of how they had to be done to work in the prime. This is a voluntary observing ship weather report. So there are ships equipped with satellite transmitters and weather stations that transmit generally hourly their conditions, and that's posted to NOAA. This is one of the early weather things we processed. So each of these is, and they're time-coded over the last 24 hours. So if I open the time slider here, this is probably the same ship in its reports over a certain amount of time. The arrows indicate wind direction if the ship reports wind. As the background color changes, that represents sea state. The arrow color is wind speed, so as it goes to like red or dark, it's actually, I think the background color in these is visibility. So as they go to black, that means there's worse and worse visibility locally. We did some weather overlays like the sea surface temperature, wind and wave forecast products. We geocoded those, did time-based animations. Basically built this whole sort of library of, you know, all the other things you might want to look at with marine charts.
How are we doing on time? Just out of curiosity, what's our?
You know, 18 minutes.
That's okay. It? All right.
Oh, actually, yeah. You can go until 2:15, I forgot.
Yeah.
How much?
You can go until 2:15.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, so again, right after we released the ENC product, basically the next feedback is, well, this is great, but, you know, there's 400 missing charts because they're still doing ENC conversions. So we said, okay, well, we got to do RNC. So we converted all the RNCs to KML. Unfortunately, you know, what's 1.2 gigabytes of data in ENC for the U.S. is turned out to be about 35 gigabytes of data in RNC. So I took 5D, we created 5 regional DVDs for the RNC. The neat thing in Google Earth is you can overlay vector in Google Earth, always goes over raster in Google Earth, so you can actually run raster on top of Google Satellite with ENC on top of that. And that was actually very interested to some of the NOAA guys down in D.C., and their charting office bought all our software because, again, people would say, well, I've looked in Google Earth and your chart's wrong, and they wanted a way to directly compare, again, their chart to Google Earth. And we found cases that voters pointed out where the ENC had been corrected, the RNC had not, and so by having the three together, you could basically multi-vote against which one was wrong a little bit based on multiple sources. This time we also got into consulting. We did KML design for National Geography Week, for National Geographic for 3 years. We've done things for other nonprofits. Here's just a screen capture. This is, again, ENC vector over RNC raster down in the southwest Florida. So again, challenges. Working in Google Earth, you're slave to someone else's user interface. It's easier when it's a science thing. It's sort of self-directed, but when you're selling it as a product, it can be really challenging, especially a consumer product. You could connect GPS to Google Earth, but it was sort of tricky and prone to failure. So unless you were a techie, it was a plug and play. And so we ended up, people would be happy with the system once they learned it, but there was a lot of tech support to overcome. Air cards helped the caching and the offshore access quite a lot, but there was still always, Google Earth didn't have a systematic way to cache data. You had to go in and sort of hand browse an area. And where this compounded is the more successful we got, the more likely was that our customer wasn't a techie. So, the initial adopters, we didn't have a lot of tech support challenge because, again, the person at that time prone to buy this initially was a power user, but as we got more and more popular and it went sort of down the chain of users, it became more and more difficult to sustain the product. Google, while they were iterating what Google Earth and Maps could do quite quickly, they were also breaking a lot of things in the process. Google a lot of times doesn't see their, they see their free APIs as important, but they, since Google doesn't, the people engineering those at Google, they don't sell those. So a lot of times they don't fully understand the fact that you have to maintain backwards compatibility if you've got a lot of users who've built stuff on their system. And so that was frustrating sometimes. This brings us about October 2008. We got a long-term consulting contract along with investment from Brad, and that allowed me to sort of come from what, at that, I'd done about a year part-time with MITRE, part-time on Earth and Sea. I moved full-time in October 2008. Again, that was when our customer support was starting to ramp up. Having a customer pool now that would buy enhancements and buy new things, motivating moving products out faster. That was also about the time Google Maps became fully capable in version 2 of the API to handle decent amounts of vector data and to be able to handle custom tile layers. So we also started building the online charting capability. And moving to maps, you lose 3D, but you regain to some degree the control of the user interface, which was a big thing. We moved a lot of the vector data. We couldn't really do big KML files anymore, so instead we put all the ENC data into a spatial database instead, and went to more a REST-based query for a bounding box and return just the layers in view. That turns out the ENC is about 300,000. Data points, if you're talking about name sea areas, navigation aids, lights, wrecks, and obstructions. If you add depth sounding, that's about 2 million points. We wrote a lot of custom APIs, again, for these NOAA web services so we could query them spatially on our server, get back XML for plotting, but also sort of pass-through APIs. So if somebody says, okay, I click on this one, and now I want the weather buoy report, whatever the most recent is. Well, we proxy that request out, grab the most recent so it's less than 6 minutes old and post it to the user in formatting it basically in between, setting that up so we could format on demand. Should I send XML back to some apps? Should I send formatted HTML back to others? So there was some flexibility of whether you were doing client-side styling or just pop it out there to the user. That led to, again, building proficiency in JavaScript and sort of AJAX design principles. By late 2009, so now here we're another year later, Google Earth was starting to reach a degree of maturity at Google, and Google was sort of moving on in their attention to Android particularly. boating community, this is now the time that the iPhone is starting to get wide adoption. The iPad, I don't know if it was out quite yet, but it was on the horizon. And so what we're seeing is, for many years, everybody in the boating community was going to laptops, because that was the mobile computing device prior to the smartphone. And the price points were dropping. But as soon as smartphones really started to gain market traction, the laptop revolution died, at least in boating. Because again, if your choice is a laptop on a small boat or a smartphone, the smartphone's going to win every single time. And then once the iPad came out, it was game over, really, for the laptop. So we began late in 2009 on our iOS Android apps, and then released Marine Charts 1.0 in the summer of 2010.
I think it's, oh, you were about to say, I'm sorry, I was just going to say, I think it's worth pointing out that this transition, it seems like it's compressed in time, but it really took on, it was definitely a couple of years, and Virgil and I would go to these boat shows, and it was laptops and a real discrimination against the notion of even an iPhone. On a boat, you know, it was a beautiful device. Why would you do? Why would you have that anywhere near water? Those kinds of things. So there was really a lot of trepidation about doing these kinds of things. But we still, I think, I don't remember what the basis of our hunch was, but we decided to go ahead and do these, start developing mobile apps. And I just say anecdotally, the transition in the leisure boating community has been incredible. I mean, it really has. So.
Yeah. So like I said, you know, our last retail DVD sale was summer 2011. We still do sell that to institutional customers. We don't really do much outbound marketing outside of the App Store and our website. We do the Miami and Fort Lauderdale boat shows. You know, so over 3 years of the Google Earth product, we've got into the thousands of users. You know, within 1 year of the iPhone, iPad app, we were into the 10,000s of users. So again, clearly different order of magnitude adoption. And that there's, you know, that's going to grow and grow and grow in the near future. And so now our iPad app's $20 a year, and it models and in a lot of ways exceeds the features of many multi-$1,000 units.
And I think it's important to note that we give the form factor for the iPad a lot of credit, but there is the data side of this, and I think the ability to consume multiple data layers simultaneously. You know, if you have charts and you have weather, and soon hopefully AIS and things like that, the convergence of all those data layers on a device like the iPad is really something that's novel. Because on a boat, as you probably know, there's different displays and dedicated device for almost each one of those layers. And so the convergence of all that is an order of magnitude change in kind of what's required to go boating safely. And one other kind of point of all this is we stumbled into the leisure boating space that Virgil mentioned, but there seems to be a huge appetite for this stuff increasingly lately in the commercial side. So port pilots, researchers, other forms of, you know, commercial shippers and things like that. So it's the form factor and the multiple layers over these geo servers is really disrupting the entire kind of navigational infrastructure industry right now.
Yeah, so our current product family, we have our Marine Charts product on iPhone, iPad. We have an Android version that is slightly less featured. We have our Google Maps-based online chart viewer that's currently V2. We have the V3 in prototype and hopefully be moving that out very quickly. We have what I call our raster vector nautical data service. So like Brad said, we've had commercial entities who had legacy software products, usually like desktop, situational awareness, desktop GIS, basically come to us and say, well, you know, we've been doing it this way for years, but it's slow, it's hard to update, it's hard to maintain. You know, could we just integrate your chart database? And, you know, we say, yeah, and it's pretty simple. And so, again, they pay us essentially annual service fees based on their usage, and they get an updated chart set all the time, and they don't have to maintain it. Also, a lot of them are wanting to move more towards web apps and software as a service themselves to get out of building desktop applications. And so our data naturally supports that. Whale Alert's a new product done in conjunction with Roland and others here. We just announced in Boston yesterday in conjunction with Stellwagen National Sanctuary, so showing all seasonal and dynamic management areas for right whales on the East Coast. Doing alarms, basically geofences, when you enter any of those managed areas with your app, it alarms and links you to the regulations. It shows all the acoustic buoy status, can work fully offline, capable, works over AIS or internet, depending on your connectivity, and that's free on the App Store right now. So that's one of our new pushes into more the environmental space. And again, in general, what we've learned on how to manage spatial data goes into other domains. We manage spatial data for an aeronautical chart app, so we do all FAA nautical charts on a monthly basis. Getting into hiking maps, topo maps, all can use sort of the same software we've developed. So, you know, what really goes into what we do, you know, on the raster products, you have geocoding and cropping. So, in the ideal world, you get raster products that are GeoTIFFs or BSB or have some sort of embedded geo information and projection. A lot of times the world's not ideal and somebody needs some data, and it's, if you're lucky, it has the projection in some lat-long grid lines so you can geocode it. Sometimes it takes even more handwork than that. But we have a pretty good system so that if it is not a native geo product, once it's converted once, as long as they don't change the borders on us, we can maintain that in the database to reprocess updates in the future. Get into a lot of cropping. Of course, all the NOAA raster charts come with borders. So they have border information built in to an extent, but they also have anomalies in some of them that are misshapen where the border data is not usable. So again, we have a system that uses the border data to the best, but we can override it on a persistent basis for the individual charts to crop to different boundaries if we know there are problem areas. From there, again, the challenge in raster is there are 1,000 or so raster charts. There are actually about 2,000 individual images or cells with insets and other things in the raster system. What we want to do is we didn't want to have a system where the user had to select a chart number. We wanted just a system where the user, I am here, and I'm going to zoom in to whatever the appropriate level of detail is, and I just want to see the best available at my zoom level. So, again, we basically created a spatial database of, so each individual chart is tiled into 256 by 256 pixel tiles at about 6 zoom levels. So we created a spatial database, which was the sum of all tiles in the whole raster chart set, along with information about their native zoom level, the zoom level of the tile itself, some priority rules that we can hand modify where necessary, where we get anomalies on borders, and then wrote code that basically can process over this giant database one tile per unique tile address in the world that have, for every square we have data for, applies the priority rules, but it also then can mix the tiles. So if you're on a chart border and the one chart ends halfway through the tile is transparent, say on the east side, and you have the other chart comes up and is, you know, overlaps a little bit, but then has a transparency on the other side, our system will combine those such that there's no gaps and it applies the priority of which one goes on top of the other where it's non-transparent.
People are just nervous about time.
We're about to the end.
Okay.
With that, managing updates, like on the RNC charts, our database also tracks basically what version of the chart we're on, when was the last update date. And so once a week, we have an automated system that checks NOAA's update list, pulls down anything with more recent additions, reprocesses just those charts and any areas covered by those charts, and pushes that back up to the live server. So our live server tile set is within 7 days of the latest NOAA has, pretty much on a permanent basis. We're actually moving to being able to detect changes on the tile level themselves rather than just the chart level, which will greatly reduce the bandwidth and processing time. That's something we want to do in the future. And this is all done on Amazon EC2 and Amazon S3. So it's all cloud-based. We can spin up new servers when we need to. The tile sets are on what's called their simple storage service. It means it's quintuple redundant. We never worry about bandwidth because that scales up, scales down, and we just pay a fixed bandwidth cost based on usage. In the vector products, some similar ideas. Spatial database is really the key thing. Building a sort of a master index table of all our features across all our layer types, so for quick query. And then that indexes into child tables that would have, you know, full details or metadata. So the quick query gets everything to display on the map with the basics like the name. And then when it's clicked on, it can generate then the request in the child table that gets the full amount. That helps keep the bandwidth reasonable. And the user still feels like it's really fast. We built, you know, full text indices against all the NOAA place name data, so you can search for, you know, a cove or something that's in the charts. It's not in a land-based database. So we are trying to look at how we broker access to third party. And we sort of built some, right now we're doing a lot of JSON as our output format and made it so that our Google Maps system and our mobile app system use the exact same output. So we code once on the server. Just some quick advantages. Again, our tile formats are all in geospatial consortium TMS, which means they work in just about every map engine available right now. So you know, it's been easy. Again, when we get vendors say, well, I'm thinking of going to Google Maps for my thing, can we chart to work? Yep, here's two lines of code. JSON, again, is also very easy to parse. There's native libraries in most of your programming languages to process JSON. It's more compact than XML or KML. And it's pretty easy to translate to KML or other things if we need to. I'm just going to skip past that. So things we're immediately working on is, again, the change detection for updates, how to get more. We're always looking for more and more real-time weather and other data of interest. And then it's finishing with taking sort of Kurt's work with LibAIS that we use in WhaleSpotter. So we're going to be building a more robust AIS capability in our apps, and also working with SiriusXM. They have a data system for weather over satellite, and building compatibility with that in our app if the user has their hardware and subscription. Brad, you want to talk future?
Well, I think the future is getting clearer, but it's not completely clear yet. I think our nomenclature for Live Map has corollaries to this notion of the chart of the future, in the sense that I think what we're seeing is we're seeing a change in terms of expectation about how a map or how a system feeds data to a user and how current that weather, how current that data is and the weather and the data type itself. And so it starts with charts, which only includes weather, includes things like, it's really situational awareness. And we see markets now, we see a market emerging where being able to aggregate this across different data sources and against different agencies and make this whole data ecology not only live but more consumable on the web and in mobile formats, a real business opportunity. And so where we're moving in that direction, I think the mobile app store framework where you have subscription services for things like discrete data feeds, whether or not it's radar imagery or weather feeds, things like that, allows users to kind of configure their iPhones to consume whatever weather data, whatever data types are relevant for where they are at that time. I don't know how many of you guys saw The Matrix, right? You remember that scene where the guy, it's a woman actually, who she needs to learn how to fly the Sikorsky 150 helicopter. So she calls Tank, she goes, I need to learn how to fly a Sikorsky helicopter stat. And Tank puts in the module, and sure enough, she learns how to fly it, now she can fly a helicopter. Well, interestingly, I think these phones are changing. We're starting to expect that, to be able to download the data right now, right here. Some of the data is going to be free. A lot of it will be free. A lot of it's publicly, publicly available data sitting there for the aggregation, but a lot of it will be premium, and it just depends on who's producing what for what purpose. But we see this in kind of strictly a navigational sense being a huge market opportunity for boaters of all types, again, leisure boaters, commercial boaters, kayakers, fishermen. They all seem to have an appetite for this. So. Our map platform kind of begins to think about this in a much broader perspective than simply just a chart, and that's I think where we're heading with this. The crowdsourcing, we talked about that a little bit with Colin and crew this morning, but this is definitely a thing that's beginning to happen where users are federating knowledge about the situation in their particular boating area, and they're beginning to trust peer input on whether or not something is a shoal has developed or is shoaling, or a buoy has a particular move. I wouldn't say they completely trust that yet. So there's going to be a market for a long time for certified navigational data. There will always be a market for that, but there's also going to be a growing market for crowdsourcing situational awareness data. We see a huge opportunity there as well. And there's a lot of heuristics associated with how do you make that viable. How is it that crowdsourced data actually can become actionable? And so that's so the live map, if you will, for lack of a better moniker, is the sum of all of these parts and something we're actively investigating. We talked about some of the stuff. I think the other thing, going back to the platform, we spent a lot of our time on kind of the web services and the web server side of this, but clearly the mobile platform is part of our instrument of construction. And so having all this capacity in the mobile device that allows you to actually ascertain where you are and absorb all these feeds is pretty significant. But things like multiple network support, AIS support, there are ways we can continue to innovate on the mobile platform that makes it even more valuable, and not just for the consumer, but for the commercial class. We talked about how we would deliver the data, whether or not subscription servers, the different layers. And then there's the what we call the operators. So right now, as I explained, most boaters want to know where I'm at right now. Where am I in relationship to the most current information? Where am I in relation to this chart and what's happening weather-wise? But certainly using these things for planning and for scenario analysis and stuff like that, there's a whole rubric of list of things that people want to be able to do on that data. And so making that very easy to do is certainly a fundamental part of the platform in this map. So.
Yeah, this last slide.
And then, to the extent that you guys are interested in the business side of this, we're obligated to look at it from a business perspective. So what are the opportunities for us as a business? And I mentioned earlier that we have about 30,000 iOS subscribers to our current mobile app. Android is a significant less than that, but it's growing pretty rapidly. But in our world, we think in terms of large numbers. So how do we get to a million subscribers? Many of them can be free, right? And some can be premium. And how do we slice and dice that market? And then beyond consumer, we really are starting to pay a lot of attention to the professional side and the environmental side. And the environmental side is kind of, as I said earlier, it's we believe we can do well and do good. And this whale alert project was really an exercise in that. We did a lot of free work for the purposes of getting that app off the ground. But it's opened up kind of a world of an opportunity for us where having sensitive environmental data in the hands of both professionals and consumers alike seems to be a really big opportunity for us. So from a business standpoint, this is where we'd like to take the platform. And I think coming back to why we're here today in CCOM is we were good, obviously, from some of the technological underpinnings of how you grab and optimize data for consumption across the different platforms. But we're pretty good at developing the go-to-market strategies for actually making that a commercially viable exercise. So a little bit of both. So we dove in deep on the technical side and a little bit on the business side. Hopefully, we didn't know which way to go on this, so we apologize if we did too much of one thing. But with that, are there any questions on either vantage point? We successfully prepared to sleep.
I'm just curious, how big is your company now? How many employees do you have?
You're looking at the full-time employees right here, the two of us. in fairness, there's a whole other discussion about how the virtualization of companies has manifested itself. So we no longer need to go buy a bunch of servers. We no longer need fixed offices. Google Apps and Google Mail and all the cloud-based services has really made us all a lot more efficient. But in practice, it's Virgil and I on kind of the day-to-day business. We do have a in-depth development relationship with a mobile development team out in Berkeley, California. They're staff of about four people, and then we work with other contractors for different aspects. So it's an interesting case study in how much damage two people can do, right? But I will say this, a part of this also is that you have, when you're starting a business, you have to be nimble, you have to be smart about how much you invest, whether or not it's your money or somebody else's money. So we're at this threshold now where we feel comfortable enough to go out there and raise capital and commit to shareholders that we can return the investment that they would make. So that's what we're going to be spending a good amount of time doing these next few months, is raising capital to go after some of these markets we talked about. And we are being obviously somewhat vague about some of these things because this is a public forum, but we do have a plan to go out there and get some capital. And I think we'll become a bigger company, but we're going to be smart about it. So this is it. Long answer to your question, but right now this is it.
Do you see having links to kind of information, you know, like Habbo information, pubs and restaurants and all that kind of stuff? Is that
we actually do. We glossed over that, but early on, even the web services side, we have relationships with a number of what we call publishers. But these are marina directories, people who provide directories of marinas themselves, what information about those marinas, fuel prices, and stuff like that. And we haven't pushed that too hard just because there has been a real clear economic model that makes sense for us specifically. We're not in the advertising business, which is where we go to do that. But at some point, people keep coming to us, can they embed our viewer in their directory services and things like that. So there's definitely a market for that at some point.
So why are you not in the advertising? I'm just curious from the business point of view. I mean, that's what obviously Google makes all their money that way.
The honest answer is I think we're a little bit too we're techie at this point. I think we're interested in solving some of the technical problems still associated with this. And right now, and what I'll also say is, just on sheer economics, right now, people are willing to pay us $20 a year for essentially the consumption of charts and weather on a mobile device. That's pretty attractive from a number of vantage points. It's simple to market. Once you get an app into the Apple market and you can do the things to get the rankings high and all that, a lot of your marketing and distribution is taken off of your hands. So there's real attractiveness to that. What you have to do to make money in advertising, you're talking about tens of millions of hits, to really make that an interesting business. And in the challenge of that, the boating maritime market is not that big of a market yet, unfortunately.
Yeah, and the mobile advertising market, just to belong onto that, is still not solved, even in, apps that have, again, multi-millions of users a day are still struggling really to monetize via advertising. One, because the metrics aren't really nearly as good as web tracking metrics. And that's not getting easier, that's getting harder because Apple's locking down device IDs and other systems that were at least beginning to build the statistical base. So again, the beauty, to sell advertising, you really have to be able to go to somebody who's going to buy and say, I can promise you this many views, and this is the demographic of our user, and to make that case. That's just really hard to do right now in the mobile space in general, let alone in something specific like marine.
Not to over-answer this question, there's also something else, Brianna, you touched on this earlier, which is how many times did you use charts before you went out on your boat, right? Why? Because it's archaic, it's all. So I think there's, as informational becomes more easily consumed and valuable, then you see the base actually using this information grow and grow substantially. So, and they bleed over, so a person taking a kayak trip versus someone who's cruising down intercoastal can become, in terms of the consumption of the information, one and the same. And that's when those numbers get interesting from an advertising standpoint. And we still may pursue that, but right now, if you go back to what we said earlier, people were paying hundreds of dollars, if not thousands of dollars, for the range of maps and electronics to serve those maps and all that. And we're charging $20 a year. And so we're just beginning to penetrate that market. And we'll probably slice it up a little bit so there's a little more of a an econ phrase, but more wallet share and yield. But we think we're just at the beginning of all of this right now. And advertising is a long, hard road to do that. So. Good questions. Any questions on the technology side or anything like that, or what we're doing there? Yes, sir.
You mentioned some of the problems with utilizing those information.
This is John Kelly. He runs Nowco.
Okay, great. Yes, that's one of the better notes.
So I know we have our own problems. We realize with NOAA how sometimes poorly we put our information out.
Yeah.
And available, especially for these kind of mobile devices and even just desktop. So
yeah.
What are the main problems you've seen with our information? Well,
so
the service NOS.
Right. One, first I'll say is every NOAA person we've ever dealt with has been outstanding. So, and that's the honest truth. I mean, we've worked with
provided coffee.
Yeah, right. Yeah. We've interacted with lots of different people at NOAA over the years. That's actually been a very positive, and I know a lot of them share the same frustrations a lot of times. The for me on the vector data side, in terms of navigational data, what would be wonderful would be some sort of spatial database that is essentially everything that's in ENC with no duplications. that has some sort of unique ID that's maintained across updates over the life cycle of an object. So again, because that's how you would really want to power a vector chart system. Because, and then you could run updates literally on the object level, because you'd have an update list and you'd just, you know, these are new, these are gone, these are changed, and it'd be really straightforward. Because the challenge is, like I said, a lot of these systems, it doesn't make sense to really maintain the traditional chart borders, which are legacy from the RNCs. The Navy, which is interesting, we actually did a project for DNC conversion, which is the Navy vector chart to KML, and they use a similar sort of zoom scale resolution system, but they're all on square grids. So when you build DNC charts to KML, you don't have the overlap. As long as you control what's on it, with the zoom levels in terms of the chart scales, there's never any overlap issues because none of their charts overlap each other across the border. So that's, and I know, like I said, you know, that's ENC is partly where it is because it's a derivative of RNC, and I'm sure there were all sorts of reasons there was no way to do a clean slate when they were originally created. But you know, some sort of database of all the chart objects would be really neat. You know, the team here, of course, has already worked a lot with Coast Pilot, you know, a geocoded version of the Coast Pilot where every place name in that is geotagged and machine readable. You know, that would be really neat. Local notices to mariners, which is more a Coast Guard issue. Again, they're not machine readable and really should be, because if they're machine readable, they'd be very easy to get out on the web and into the mobile devices.
Yeah, can I just, what was your name?
John.
John. One of my favorite bosses told me, he said, where there was a mystery, there was a margin, right? But we are, I mean, I think to Virgil's point, we are huge benefactors of public data. And I think our whole business has been just to help make it a little more digestible. So we're always willing, but we have no proprietary rights, obviously. And I think we've had interim discussions with some people in NOAA from time to time about relicensing back what we do or whatever. So we're always, whatever, we're wide open to that, because we know that our job is to add value to that data in some way or another, and I think there's always a continuum of that. So but I think the point is we're not proprietary about this at all.
As far as the RAS rate, NowCoast has been a great system. We don't have it in the mobile product yet, but it's coming very soon. Having the WMS is, it'd be great to have it in TMS natively, but proxying WMS as if it was TMS is not that hard to do, so that's what we wrote basically our own proxy for it. I'm trying to think on the... There is one thing on that, because it would be neat to have the radar available in the last 6 time slices, each on a separate service.
We're working on it.
Okay. We implemented our own using the FTP radar data, but it basically means we have to run our own server to fuse that data, and if we hit it via WMS, it'd be a little easier. But I think NowCoast has been a good example from within NOAA of better ways to do things by standardizing to a pretty good degree, even though there's, you know, 30 or however many different data feeds, how you access them is all still pretty similar, so you don't have to recode, you know, 10 different, I could write one function and I could get any of your layers by passing essentially a different layer argument rather than having to write 20 different functions to get it in.
One more plug to you guys, though. I could say 99.9% of our business is in the US, and it's because of your agency and other agencies, you know, the US agencies. International is still a mess, as you know, whether or not it's licensing, the data quality, and all that stuff, it's a completely different world. So.
Guy Knoll is watching remotely, and he was wondering if you're working with any WaveGlider data, and specifically the PAC-X challenge, and doing any analysis of the robotics glider data.
Mike, you know, Desiree.
Okay, we're not at this point. I mean, I know what gliders are, and I've looked at that. You know, PC's particular, you know, thing we should look at, I'd certainly be interested. We've done some work with the Sikora and GCUS organizations and IUS. Because we're, you know, they're Florida, or, you know, they handle parts of Florida, and so, you know, I've gone to some of their meetings, and again, it's a good way to at least collaborate on what their data needs are and what new data is being collected. We've done a little bit like with the HF radars and displaying that. That's something we've long-term want to get better in our products too, is that availability has gotten quite a bit better just in the last few years. I think they got funding after Katrina to rebuild those radar networks.
Do you talk a lot about observational data? Do you incorporate model data for it all?
Right, not a lot. Like I said, the NowCoast, one of the things the current products out of NowCoast is probably the first thing we're going to put in out of NowCoast in the mobile apps. The thing with models is you have to understand what they are.
That disclaimer, basically.
And to really know where they're, I'm a boater and and been in science enough, I know a little bit, but that's where I really look to, places like CECOM or Sikora I used to educate us as a company on, hey, we have these great things, here's how we think boaters could use them, and we definitely want to play that role. If there's, modeling products that you feel have operational value that just aren't getting exposure, we'd love to help, figure that out.
So have you looked at the ports data from NOAA?
Yes.
Tides and currents. And it's like
soap.
Yes. What'd you say?
It's a soap service.
Oh, okay. Well,
I actually have, two years ago, I actually have all the code written to query it. And near as I can tell, a lot of it's already sort of available in the NDBC data feeds. Some maybe isn't. This is something I haven't had time to get back to revisit. And again, and maybe they've got a REST service now, which would be, no, okay, be really great. But
looks like we're out of time.
Yeah.
So listen, we appreciate you guys hosting us, and it's great to meet you guys all. Hopefully this was interesting.
Thank you guys very much.